from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a brick. Reuters reports that, according to LGBTQ legend, a black transgender woman named Marsha P. Johnson threw the first brick at the Stonewall Inn, which sparked the gay liberation movement 50 years ago. Historians say it's debatable whether Johnson's act was the first in the rioting, but they can confirm that she and other trans women of color, another one named Sylvia Rivera, were the leaders of the movement, where members of the LGBTQ community fought for their rights and fought back against near constant harassment. But as Reuters goes on to report, while Stonewall and the months following the riots were a time of unity for the LGBTQ community, that would not last long. Gay white men assumed leadership positions, and the voices of activists of color were mostly pushed aside. The rift in the community still exists today, and some LGBTQ activists of color say it will be difficult to make progress toward unity. And this hour, we're joined by LGBTQ activists of color, not only going to share their stories, the challenges they face, and their ideas for how to create a more inclusive community, but also we'll have a conversation about outcomes. And frankly, whether they're optimistic, whether we're going to see outcomes improve for everyone. So let's have that conversation. And hello to our guests in studio. And welcome back to Shawnee Wilson, who is a physician assistant at Trillium Health and co-chair of Trillium's Diversity and Inclusiveness Council. And listeners might remember that Shawnee was on a recent program talking about faith, among other things. A very powerful voice, and we're glad to have you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Christopher Goodwin. Chris is a supervisor at the MOCA Center at Trillium Health. Chris, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome to Erica DeJesus, a PrEP specialist at Trillium Health. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Hello to Tim Brumfield, who is a PrEP specialist at Trillium as well. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bill Valenti is co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. Dr. Valenti, always good to see you. Thank
you. Good afternoon.
Talking to Shawnee after that show, and we had this conversation about ways to kind of broaden this conversation, beyond what we talked about in our last conversation. What came to mind first before we kind of hear these stories, which I suspect will all be powerful, and I hope our listeners have set aside time this hour or can sneak away from work or maybe sit somewhere and then just kind of sit with these stories. Why did you want to make sure we bring this conversation together now?
Wow, I think because of everything that's happening nationally, everything that's happening locally, these are our jobs every day. This is the community that we live in, this community that we serve. And especially we talk about, healthcare disparities and, trying to make inroads with LGBTQ people of color. It has its challenges and it has its rewards. But at the most time, we are constantly trying to figure out, even within our own community, as being a woman of color, black woman myself, trying to figure out how to make inroads into my own community. And especially when it comes to me being a physician assistant, having to talk about how to reach people that look like me to also engage in healthcare, but also knowing that the bigger picture is that it's about trust and it's about a really longer story, a bigger story, saying that, to service and to have that being part of the community of LGBTQ means that, there's a lot of mistrust and there's a lot of trust that has to be gained in order to move forward as far as like in the community in general.
Are you an optimist that things are really going to change?
You know what, believe it or not, I am. I am an optimist, believe it or not. You know why? Because of here today, the people that are here today, really. Because we have Dr. Valenti here, we have Chris, Erica, and Tim, and these are the next generation of people that are passionate about reaching out to our own population and seeing good things happen. And because of that, with Black Pride and other events that are happening around the city, people are getting engaged younger in these kinds of issues because of our political climate. So absolutely, I do.
Dr. Valenti, when it comes to outcomes, I mentioned off the top, there's a disparity in outcomes. Let's talk a little bit about what that means. What's that look like?
People of color, higher risk for new HIV infection, because the epidemic has shifted to people of color. So men of color who have sex with men are one emerging group. The other part of that is being marginalized, keeps people from not only accessing care, but once they access care, they have problems staying in care because there are a variety of those kinds of issues that need to be addressed, from housing, insurance, employment, etc. So yeah, people who stay in care and under our watchful eye, for example, do better over the long haul. And we can sort of equalize those disparities by addressing the social issues, retaining people in care, and working with them. But it's a heavy lift at times because there are a variety of societal issues that we're trying to confront at the same time.
Hmm. Well, I want to hear some individual stories, and I want to ask a question that's probably admittedly a little clumsy. I'll start with Shawnee on this. When we talk about Pride, mm-hmm. as a festival, as an event, do you think, largely speaking, not to overgeneralize, but, you know, the LGBTQ community of color hears Pride and thinks, well, that's white Pride. That historically has been white Pride.
Yep.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair question?
I would say it's pretty fair.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say so. I think, you know, when you talk about the history of, you know, the gay movement, where, you know, you talked about Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, right? And, you know, Stonewall 50 just came on WXXI, you know, the documentary. And one of the part of the documentaries that I remember is that, you know, Sylvia was standing in, I think it was Columbus Circle or Washington Square Park, one of those in New York City, just screaming and being like, when she was being booed by the general community, the general white community in the center. And she was like, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you listening to us? You know, she's like, I've been, you know, beaten, I've lost my job, and a lot of other things have happened to me because of the same, we have the same passion, and we have the same equality, like we need equal rights just like you. So, you know, when we talk about like divide, it's that there's always an air of invisibility that happens, unfortunately, even stemming back then. It was like, well, we can talk about rights because everybody wants to have them, but when it came down to it, a lot of folks in the LGBTQ community, people of color, are screaming about their invisibility, and you know, there are people working to make sure that doesn't happen. But I still think that, you know, just like Dr. Valenti said, we really have a lot of social issues and stuff like that really make that difficult.
Dr. Valenti, why do you think it's happened like that over the years? I mean, this is really the question of America in many ways.
Yeah.
And it's a question of power and influence and who has control. And sometimes it's overt and intentional, and sometimes it is sort of more implicit. But why do you think in the LGBTQ movement there has been this kind of divide, going all the way back post-Stonewall?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that racism is foundational to this society, and the common theme of being gay or LGBT isn't really enough at times to overcome that. That's why, you know, I was puzzled in the beginning as to why we had Black Pride and White Pride as two separate entities. Now I understand it better. I still think we should strive for more unity, though. But it also speaks to the heavy lift here in terms of getting to that point.
Has it been a case where if you had confusion about that at the beginning, just listening, has that helped? I mean, just kind of opening up to hear these stories?
Well, listening, watching, working with my younger colleagues and paying attention, because I've tried to narrow the generation gap. I lie about my age, but I also listen.
Well, let's talk to some of your colleagues. Erica DeJesus is a PrEP specialist at Trillium Health. And Erica, if you could first, why don't you kind of give me your story on identity and how you sort of see yourself and how maybe your community has seen you?
I guess that's a little complicated. You know, when we talk about identity, rarely is it ever one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like Dr. Valenti said, it's not just being LGBTQ identified is not enough, and it's not just the one thing that you can hold on to or that you can identify as. For myself, I identify as Latina. I am Latina, a lesbian, and I'm an immigrant. So those are three major identities that I'm trying to navigate in my life. And so I feel like I'll never break through all three because I'll break through one or get comfortable in one, and then there's another one. So,
how has your identity, who you are as a lesbian, impacted you, maybe in your family and in the Latino community?
Oh, wow, in so many ways. In a lot of ways, well, I guess in the most important one has been judgment. Not only, it's not just like my Latina identity, but being like an immigrant and being brought to this country and being told like, we brought you here to have a better life, to have a good life. And that life involved marrying a man and having a family. And so breaking that was very hard. And then, you know, coming out meant I had to tell my parents that you brought me to this country, but I'm not going to marry a man, and I'm not going to live this heteronormative life that was supposed to be better for me. So that was hard. And then just every day in within my community, there's tolerance, I guess, but there's rarely any acceptance.
I think that's a very interesting distinction. Because for years, there's been this conversation about, well, we need tolerance, as if tolerance is sort of the gold standard. Like, well, I may not approve of you, but I'll tolerate your right to at least sit at the table.
Right.
It seems to me now that it's pretty clear that tolerance is sort of weak tea compared to what we're really going for.
Yeah, because, I mean, tolerance is packed with microaggressions and... It's like you can have a seat at the table, but you're the butt of the joke. So it was hard because it became very clear that I had to separate myself from people that I had grown up with and people that I loved, but that were constantly judging me or that didn't understand and weren't really trying to understand, were more so, again, trying to be funny. And so it was hard, and it's still hard. I think every time I'm around like a lot of people that I grew up with, a lot of family members, and there are comments made, and I have to either make the choice to fight or be silent, and that's a struggle. I don't want neither.
And to state the obvious, as we talk to all of our guests, I mean, we're having a conversation that goes pretty deep here. I don't want anyone to feel like, you know, if you want to put up a wall where we're going, or the host asked a question, you don't want to go there, obviously. You know, no. I just want to state the obvious. You don't need permission from me, but I want to be clear, because we are pushing in directions that are tough. I mean, you know, you talked about your parents. Who you came from where, by the way?
The Dominican Republic.
Okay, and so has there been evolution over time with either your parents or your family or friends who didn't understand or didn't approve at first?
Mostly aunts and uncles, I think. Cousins that are around my age get it a lot more, and my mom has been tolerant, but in a way that I can accept, I guess, you know.
Okay. It sounds like you have lost some relationships.
I have.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the good things, at least, about being LGBTQ is, and that I heard from the beginning, is that you truly do get to choose your own family. And I have lost relatives, but I have gained a lot of family.
It's a powerful statement. When did you come out?
I was 20 years old.
How long had you known before you decided to come out?
I actually didn't know very young. I was not the girl who dated in high school. All my friends were gay males. So I was just always the odd one out. I was like, I don't want anyone to ask me out. I don't want a date. I don't want nothing. Funny enough, people always told me that I was gay before I ever thought about not being straight.
And was there sort of a moment, or just like that revelation to you?
Yeah, I decided, you know, that I wanted to start exploring sex and sexuality, mm-hmm. and it very quickly hit me that I was gay. It wasn't, I don't think, a deep revelation. Sure. It was more like, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
And did you, upon that thought, did you think this is not going to be a fun conversation for me with different people?
So I think having experience like that coming out, or the different coming out stories from all my friends, who did it very quietly and did the whole, like, I'm going to sit my parents down and say, hey, mom, dad, or mom, I'm gay. I was like, no, you know what? Everyone's been saying I'm gay, and I'm just going to out and say, like, hey, guys, I'm gay. This is my girlfriend, and we're going to chill.
You were right. You can tell. You were right about me. Did you think, though, did you then think at all about what it meant to be part of that community in a country, really in a world right now, where the outcomes are quite different? Sometimes the acceptance is different within different parts of the community. Did you mm-hmm. think much about that?
I guess within the community, off the bat, not as much. Again, all my really close friends were people of color who were gay, so I came in it from a different perspective. It wasn't until I got older and I started going to more established places that I realized that divide. But I also had experienced that divide in other places that weren't LGBTQ. So I was familiar with that, like, I don't know, that feeling of coming into a space where not everyone looks like me and where I might have to lower my voice a little bit if I want to interact or fit in. So
and I'm thinking of an episode about a year ago I saw in the rebooted version of Will and Grace, in which Will is dating a younger man, and he ends up sort of breaking it up because he's frustrated that his boyfriend doesn't really know the history of what Will went through, particularly, you know, kind of in the 90s. And he's frustrated, and he's going, like, you think you have it so hard, you have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes we hear that. I mean, there are gay writers, often white men, mm-hmm. but gay writers who will say, like, look, you have no idea what we through. You think it's struggle now. I do tend to hear that from white men more. I will say that.
I think also it is a generational thing. Uh-huh. And mm-hmm. I'm going to say, at first, I before working at Trillium, I worked with middle schoolers. And middle schoolers don't care about labels. They're just like, I am dating so-and-so this week. Next week, I might date so-and-so. She has really nice hair. I have really nice hair. We're going to date. And, you know, and they would come and they would use labels, or they would not use label every time. And at first I was a little frustrated. I was like, no, there's a whole process you have to go through. And once I got out of my own head, I was like, actually, no, it's kind of beautiful that you don't need a process. You guys just love and like people for people. That's beautiful.
It's definitely interesting. The more time I spend, you know, like in my son's school, and just the conversations that kids are having, very mm-hmm. different than what I remember. Mm-hmm. And that makes me hopeful. It sounds like it makes you a little more hopeful.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm very, very hopeful.
And the reason I bring up the Will and Grace episode is because while I understand, and I would never want to downplay what, say, for example, gay white men have gone through, or gay white people have been through, who want to say, hey, I'm older and we went through the struggle and, you know, we fought for all of these things. I think it's also important, as Dr. Valenti said at the outset, to kind of step back and listen as well. What do you want sort of the white gay community to hear about the experience that you've had that might be different, that might say, look, I know you feel like you fought the battles and things mm-hmm. are different now, but here's where the challenge is.
I guess I'd want them to know that, yes, their experience is valid, but mine's is as well. And I want them to give us the space to have these conversations and share with them, and to listen. Honestly, I don't think I want more than that. I think for a long time the conversations have been had, but they've been talking over. And so if they could just sit and listen, that'd be great.
This is similar in some regards to the conversations about the women's marches, the quote women's rights movement, particularly post 2016, in which we have seen some strife among women of color, white women, leadership positions, different organizations, and some women of color in particular saying, look, for years, The fight has been about reproductive rights and very little else. And it needs to be about more. And then other women saying, you know, can't we all just come together? Did you see parallels there?
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of, again, that's when those different identities and boxes that we're all sort of in intertwine and tumble. But yeah, absolutely. Like the, I wish that it was just LGBT, but it's obviously, you know, being a woman and being, again, Latina. But yeah, unfortunately, you see a lot of these movements and they are started by women who are of color, and then they become bigger than expected. And I think they become bigger than expected because white women tend to take it and they are heard much more than us.
And so before I turn to some of your other colleagues, in the spirit of understanding that what the word tolerance means and maybe its limits, what does the word ally mean? That's a term you hear a lot, obviously, but what does it really mean?
I think to be an ally is to fight with. Like, it's just you fighting with me, you walking with me, but you letting me take the lead because it is my experience.
And are you an optimist that we will see the health disparities, the gap will shrink, that there will be more equal outcomes?
I am, and I don't think any of us would be here if we weren't optimists, you know, especially in the work that we do with PrEP and, you know, involving sexual health. It's a very difficult topic to navigate, but I am hopeful that people will want to have these conversations and that we'll recognize how much better their life could be if they did. And yeah, so keeps me very hopeful, very positive.
Erica, thanks for telling us your story.
Thank you.
I think it's powerful and valuable. I want to turn to Christopher Goodwin, who's a supervisor at the MOCA Center at Trillium Health. And Chris, I'll kind of just give you the floor and tell us a little bit about your backstory in the same way that Erica did, if you could.
Yes. So I'm originally from Nashville, Tennessee, a pastor's kid. I identified as gay then. I now identify as gender nonconforming. And I kind of dealt with the whole thing of trying to find myself. So I moved away from Nashville, moved to Atlanta, trying to identify myself, trying to get out of the small town. But one thing that I realized, it was more of an internal struggle that I was dealing with because my community didn't accept me as I was, the religious community, when I say that. And oftentimes when you heard about gay, it was always identified with HIV. So for me, it was like, okay, I'm scared. I don't know what to do. But once I became comfortable with who I was, I was able to then explore a little bit more. And in that journey, I feel that it gave me the opportunity to also give back to my community. So now that I've been working in HIV prevention for over a decade, I get to also see people who are comfortable with who they are at earlier ages, which makes me more optimistic also about the future. It makes me realize that it's okay to evolve as you go. And it's also okay to voice your opinion on how you feel so that people can grow and learn. Everyone will not accept you, and I'm okay with that, but I do want respect. And my father actually was someone who loved and accepted me as a pastor, which I was not expecting when I came out. My mother, on the other hand, is still a journey today, but she has made tremendous strides. I'm very happy with her, but it hasn't always been that way. And then when it comes to family, some people feel that they're supportive, but when you sit at the table and you hear the conversations that go on that may not be about you, but just are general conversations, you realize that they're not really supportive.
In what way?
So there's a lot of culture around, you know, still identifying men who are not necessarily the typical stereotype of man. They may be a little feminine or have this stereotypical look that people accept all the time. They'll make fun of them, or they'll use people in social media, and it's like joking, but you're sitting here with someone who is your relative at the table who is identifying as LGBT, and you're still making jokes. So how can you be a supportive or an ally if you really are still keeping stigma in the culture alive?
No, it's interesting. I mean, I confess, I thought you were going to take it in a slightly different direction. And the direction I assumed was the kind of remarks we hear sometimes when people will say, you know, I have no problem with gay friends and relatives. We all sin. We all do things, you know, like I'm not perfect. As if, you know, being part of LGBTQ community is a problem, you know, like running stop signs. But you hear that. I mean, yeah. I've heard that on this show.
Yes.
And I go, wait a second. Like, you're comparing. Mm-hmm. And they go, no, I got no problem.
Yes.
With it. That's more I'm going back to the conversation with Erica about tolerance versus, you know, have you changed? But it sounds like you have seen change in your family. Yes. Your father, your pastor father, surprised you.
Yes.
How old were you when you came out?
I was 25 at the time. And my whole reason for waiting, I wanted to wait until I was with someone who meant something to me. So when I was engaged to my fiance at the time, I went home to talk to my father, and he said, I already know, because I use his computer, and yeah.
did he say, I already know, and I love you?
Well, he had a couple of questions for me.
Okay.
His questions were, is there anything about a woman that you like? And he asked, how did I feel like as a person? And when I told him that there wasn't anything about a woman that I liked except maybe what she's wearing, he was like, okay. And then the latter part was, well, I'm here for you. And one of my favorite stories of how he supported me was I used to model when I lived in Atlanta, and there was a magazine that I was in, and he took it to church. And my mom said, I know you're not going to share that magazine with anyone. And he said, Chris, are you ashamed of who you are? And I said, no. Even in that moment, I was still battling shame. But he called me out to a point to say, do you really love who you are? Because I do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Took the magazine?
Took the magazine to church.
Oh, man, that's a great story. You threw me off track. I mean, like, I'm so engrossed with what Chris is saying. And so, you know, I want to ask you a little bit then about how we see sometimes religious communities react. Over the years here on this program, I have been occasionally, we get show ideas, pitches all the time from people, but there have been Black listeners saying, you know, you need to kind of have a conversation about where the spiritual community is, because it's not always as inclusive as it should be. But sometimes I think we overgeneralize to begin with about what it means to be Christian in this country. Is Christianity this or that? I mean, drive down East Avenue and see the signs that First Asbury's put out, and the fact that they're thinking about breaking away from the Methodist Church because of its anti-gay stance. I mean, there's some powerful and hard things going on. So we can't speak monolithically in that sense. So I want to tread carefully, but just ask you, generally speaking, do you feel that churches that are largely Black churches are tolerant, intolerant, maybe becoming more allied with the LGBTQ community? What do you see going on?
There's a mixture. I have the opportunity to meet with many pastors because I'm a seminary student too at Colgate Divinity School. And there you go through classes that teach inclusivity and tolerance, so to speak. And you see people who will say things in the class to the point where they're supportive to get a grade. And then after that class is over, you hear the conversation of, I don't believe that. Or,
wow.
I don't see it for that. And to me, that's where we are. And I don't believe we will ever get to a place where everyone will be on the same page. Because, I mean, like you said, Christianity is divided by so many. I mean, there are different types of Christians. So I don't expect that, but what I do always challenge people is to see social justice as the main thing. So if you're oppressing anyone, that's not of God. And if you don't take the issue of HIV as an issue that is impacting the community and do something about it, then you're missing the point.
Why do you think there are different outcomes? If you are part of the LGBTQ community and you're white, just generally speaking, you're more likely to have, you know, more regular treatment and medical help and the kind of life that and help and assistance that you need versus people of color. Why do you think those gaps exist?
For me, I would say it's trust, because even when you think about the inward journey, it was more so not feeling comfortable talking to people in your own family, not feeling comfortable talking to your friends. So then why would you go somewhere else and feel comfortable? And it's a place where it's a survival thing, and my medical and things don't seem as survival as my life at that moment. So.
You say you're in the seminary now?
Yes.
You're going to do what with it?
I'm actually already ordained. I was ordained in 2015.
Awesome.
Actually married my first gay couple in 2015 as well.
Wow. You're going to shake some things up, I think.
I hope so.
That's Christopher Goodman, a supervisor at the Mocha Center at Trillium Health, and just a great chance to listen to people of color sharing their stories, their experiences in the LGBTQ community here in Rochester, what it means to be an ally, what it means to be part of a community where the outcomes aren't equal. That's just a fact. So let's take our only break of the hour and we'll continue sharing these powerful stories next. Coming up in our second hour, no one is supposed to be dying in their 30s, but premature death caused by heart failure rates are on the rise in the United States. That's according to a new study. And the people most vulnerable are as young as 35 years old, men. Obesity, diabetes, partially to blame, but not entirely. We're going to talk about why. We'll talk about prevention, what you ought to know, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. 50 years ago, the story of the Stonewall Inn and the launching of the gay liberation movement, and you are going to see exhibits around the country honoring, remembering, here in Rochester, everyone from the city historian, the public libraries, they've got things that you ought to be checking out, libraries, and hearing these stories. But did you know and do you remember, if you know anything at all about Stonewall, the trans women of color who were part of what started that event and the gay liberation movement, and then a subsequent 50 years of sometimes marginalization, sometimes voices that are forgotten, and unequal health outcomes. And we've been hearing these stories this hour to help understand what life is in the LGBTQ community of color. And Tim Brumfield is a prep specialist at Trillium Health. Tim, I'm glad you're here. And if you want, kind of tell us about your story.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having me. So I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. I'm born and raised here in Rochester. As some people may know, that faith is directly in opposition to my current lifestyle and what I currently believe. So it was hard navigating growing up and having these feelings inside, but not being able to express them with the people that I loved and the people that I was around on a constant basis.
Can I just ask?
Go ahead.
When you grow up in a Jehovah's Witness family, mm-hmm. but having these feelings, how young, how early are we talking here?
So when I was younger, I really didn't know what gay was. I knew the Bible was like the scripture that always stuck in my mind was man should not lay with man. That was something that was like beat into my head. But I had these feelings, I would say, in middle school. That's a time where you don't really know what your sexuality is, or some may know what their sexuality is, but at least I didn't. It was more other people telling me that, oh, you're gay, because I wasn't around the other kids like that. My parents kept me very focused on a biblical aspect and outlook on life.
So take me through that journey then of that realization of who you are and what it was like, especially inside that family.
So when I didn't act on how I felt sexually until I was about 16. When I was 16, I thought I had found the person that I was like in love with. And of course, this was well, not of course, but this person was an older person. I think that when you're younger and you don't always get the attention or the approval you want at home, it's easy to seek that attention and approval from someone who is older and is more experienced, and you just feel like maybe you relate to them. I felt like I related to them more than I did my family. So when I was 17, fast forward a year later, one of my friends, he said he had it in my best interest, but he told my father that I was sleeping with another man. And part of the practice in that religion is, at that time I was baptized. I was a baptized Jehovah's Witness. And part of the practice is to then go before a body of what they call elders in the congregation. And so I hadn't even told my father how I felt or anything, but I found myself in a room sort of like how we're sitting today. And my father was there, and I had to lay everything out on the table, everything that I had done, how I felt about it. A big theme of that whole conversation was, you need to repent. You need to repent. The Bible says this, and this is not, you're not in line with what the Bible says.
What did you leave that conversation thinking and feeling?
For a long time, I felt alone. Following that conversation, since I was a baptized witness, I was disfellowshipped, which meant that everyone that I grew up around, everyone, the only people that I had really spent time with were now people that I could no longer talk to. Since I was still living at home, I still had to go to the Kingdom Hall. And going to the Kingdom Hall, I would just have to sit there. Everyone around me, they would notice me, but no one would talk to me, because that's the process. You're supposed to reconnect and reestablish your relationship with God during that time. But I really felt by myself. I really felt like it's hard to feel like they care, because this is what they're saying they're doing it for, because they care about you so much. But I can tell you, it doesn't feel like that at all.
Did any part of you think, maybe they're right, maybe that part of me that wants these relationships with other men is something that is either wrong or a phase or something to suppress? Or did you know fully that they were wrong, that this is who you are?
No, so definitely. I was raised from birth up until that point knowing one thing. So in my head, I still believed in my faith. It was just this time period in my life, I didn't understand how something that I loved and something that I was felt like I was such a part of could then make me feel so isolated at the same time, just because of how I was beginning to explore myself sexually.
And so I guess I'm wondering at that point, are you thinking of your future, thinking, you know, I'm JW, that's going to be the case always. I will find a way to live acceptably in the world of Jehovah's Witness, or, you know, I know who I am now, and it's going to be a difficult path, but who I am is who I am.
So I had been disfellowshipped for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then after 3 years, and during that time I was in a relationship, I ended up moving out, because at home my parents were not really talking to me unless it was on a need-to basis, mm-hmm. like any chores that needed to be done or a bill that had to be paid, because at that time I had a job. So I moved out and I moved in with my partner, and we actually moved to Buffalo. And I feel like at that time in a young man's life, it's extremely important to still have your parents, because at that time I was only 17,
yeah.
17 and a half going on 18. And I just had this overwhelming sense or feeling that I really missed my family and that I needed them. So I eventually, I was like, I'm going to go home. I'm going to suppress these feelings mm-hmm. because this is what my parents are telling me is right. And honestly, in like in our culture, it's still, you still want to please your parents to some extent. So I felt like I was doing it for them. So I had stopped dating my boyfriend. I moved back in to my parents' house. Still at this point, I couldn't talk to anybody. I stopped talking to all my friends I had like established those 3 years that I was out because I thought this is what was gonna help me fill that hole or that empty feeling. So I actually got reinstated as a Jehovah's Witness wow. after a while. And then eventually I began working at Trillium. I remember I had did a interview about PrEP in the newspaper. And after that interview, the brothers at the Kingdom Hall, they called me in the back and they were like, this is in direct opposition to what you're doing here, what you're learning here, what you're preaching here. And like, I was so scared to say it, but I knew what I was doing at Trillium and what I was talking about, how I was connecting people to care, regardless of their sexual preference, was what I wanted to do. It was what I needed to do. And so I got this fellowship again.
And I suspect that that was the end of your...
Yeah.
Yeah.
that was it.
Yeah. I don't mean to laugh. I mean, like, I'm just observing, you know, the back and forth. But mm-hmm. but here we are. And what's the relationship like with your family?
So me and my parents, we still don't talk unless it's on a need-to-know basis. A few years back, my parents actually moved to North Carolina, and one of the conversations I remember us having last was, you know, you could always move with us, but you got to cut all that other stuff out. And I'm like, I don't know, like, what stuff? Like, just try
it's
to
like
pry.
Who you are, right?
What stuff are you talking about?
Right, right.
You know, you can't come down here. You're not gonna be like, gay was never a thing that my parents said to me. They danced around the word. And, you know, so it was never a conversation that I really got to have with my parents. It was just, this is a known fact now.
I'm sorry to hear that. Are you hopeful that things will change?
Between my family, my parents, not so much. I see like their family members. They always have had a spot and a love for me. And I see that they're trying to understand like my life and trying to establish relationships with me all of the time. And for that, I definitely am grateful. As far as like with the community and the world around us, I do believe that, like Erica had mentioned earlier, I really wouldn't be here if I didn't think that something was going to change. I see now, like we got the fight before was so that we could be recognized as this culture, and we could have our rights as this culture. Now I think the fight is going even deeper, and I'm excited to see what's happening now. There's a lot of change happening now, that yes makes me hopeful that more is to come.
Well, why do you think there are different outcomes for people of color in the LGBTQ community compared to white people, Tim?
I think it comes from a different understanding based on between the two cultures as to what healthcare is and what it will do to you. I think it comes from in the community of color, sometimes seeking out healthcare is something that's like kind of poked at, like it's made fun of in a sense. We're not encouraging each other to go seek help, to go seek treatment. Seeking help as like a man in general sometimes can be seen as like you're being weak. And I think it's just going to take the conversation turning so that we can change that mindset.
All right. Briefly here, let me get an email in where Jack says, Evan keeps talking about prep specialists. Just want to know what that is.
Okay, so PrEP is a medication. It's also known as Truvada. In the past years, it was used for HIV treatment, but currently it is being used as a way to prevent the contraction of HIV. It's a pill that's taken once daily, and there's also another combination medication called PEP. PEP is Truvada and Tivicay, which is taken after what you feel may have been an exposure to HIV. All of which is available at Trillium if you ever need.
All right. In a second, I'm going to ask Dr. Villani to follow up on that. But one more question for Tim, which is this. I mean, you've gone through so much, and you're helping so many people now. But, you know, I mean, you're a man of color in the LGBTQ community. You have a lot of intersecting threads of challenge in your life. And I want to know what it means to be an ally, you know, whether it's, you know, your friends, your family, people in different quarters of power, etc. What does it mean to be an ally?
For me, it is the most humbling thing to see someone acknowledge that they don't know, that they want to know, and that they're willing to learn. So allies who come to the table with just that willingness to help wherever they can and still learn and understand, it means a lot.
That's different than sometimes what you hear, again, generalizing, but you hear plenty of people who may be straight and say, well, I don't mind gay relationships. I don't need to hear it. I don't want to hear it. You do your thing. Like, you know, I just don't want to hear it. That's
right.
Very different than saying, come to the table and learn. That's what allyship looks like to you. Be there.
Correct.
Acknowledge, learn, say when you don't know. Dr. Valenti, what's going to change some of these outcomes now? Why don't you give us a little snapshot in our community on what you think is going to make things put us on a better footing in terms of real equality here?
Well, the words that come to mind as I listen to this discussion are trust, that patients, potential patients, community people need to trust us as a medical program to do right by them. One of the things we try to do is help empower people, feel comfortable in your own skin, and there are lots of ways to do that, support groups, counseling, formal mental health therapy, a whole variety of things. The end game here, in terms of what this group does, it's all about sexual health with a big, big focus on HIV prevention that is stopping the transmission of HIV, and helping better manage and end this epidemic. So that's a high-level view, but there are lots of nuts and bolts that go into that.
And so you need help. Trillium is just one of the resources in our community. The MOCA Center is there. There's so much happening there, and it's a resource that's been in our community. Dr. Valenti, of course, has been here for a number of years. He had a big smile on his face with that. A number is what I said, Bill.
Thank you.
It's been a number. I won't say what the number is. And in our last minute or so, Shani, we could tell these stories all day. I want to give you the floor and ask you what you want our audience to really take from this hour.
Wow. So I would like the audience to take from this hour that there are a number of young LGBTQ people of color that are motivated for change in Rochester. That when they are given the floor and the opportunity, that they are more than happy and willing and do so with, you know, zeal and gusto, and, you know, correctly articulate how they feel. And we as the greater community need to make room for them and give them a place in which to speak from. Because the reason, and it all will circle back to one thing, is that when we are facing, you know, the crisis that we have in this country, you know, and in general, especially with, you know, trans women being killed, you know, HIV on the rise, you know, other, you know, mental health. And, you know, the thing is that we need to be listening to what these young people have to say. And also as in the religious community, making room and spaces to hear what people have to say, especially those that are still within the religious community. And so that's what I, so much more, but that's what I think that they should learn.
I'm so grateful
that
you reached out and brought these powerful voices here to the table here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Shawnee Wilson, and everyone here works in some capacity with Trillium Health. Shawnee Wilson, Christopher Goodwin, thank you. Erica DeJesus, wonderful hearing your story. Tim Brumfield, thank you so much for being here. And Dr. Bill Valenti, of course, thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Short break, more connections coming up.